Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla It's Friday. It's Friday, and you know what that means. Spring break! Woo! Spring break!
It's spring break in Godzilla Town.
Anguirus is jumping off of rooftops into the deep end of the pool.
You know, this was another one that was supposed to have Anguirus in it, and they kicked him out again.
We forgot to mention it last week. I think we mentioned it the first time we did the episode, and then we had to re-record the episode, and we forgot it. Anguirus was supposed to be in the last movie. Anguirus was supposed to be in the movie before that. Anguirus was supposed to be in this movie. People love Anguirus. What is this crap?
Yeah, like, instead Anguirus was replaced in this movie by a cameo, by a dead kaiju that we last saw in the movie Space Amoeba. It was that big turtle thing, Camoebus. Camoebus? I actually don't know how to pronounce that one.
Yeah, I don't know either, but it's a big turtle thing,
The big turtle thing from Space Amoeba shows up in this one.
Yeah.
As foreboding that Godzilla is coming.
Oh, I know. By the way, my name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic, right for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a senior staff writer over at Slash Film.
Woohoo! And this is our podcast where we review every single Godzilla in order. And we're approaching the near end of the Millennium Era. Well, I guess we're at the near end.
This is the near end.
Yeah, this is the penultimate film of the Godzilla Millennium Era. And it is the only one that's a proper sequel. Last week we talked about Godzilla Against Mechagodzilla, a movie that kicked ass.
It's really good.
It really is. Like, with no reservations. Like, it's a damn good movie.
The first time I went through all of the Godzilla movies, about a decade ago at this point, I had a very dim view of the Millennium Era.
Yeah.
I thought they were, like, kind of dour or less interesting. They just weren't as solidly put together, nor were they as whimsical as the Godzilla films that I enjoyed the most. Going through these again, there is whimsy here, and there's actually a lot of adventure here. I love the music in this movie. This one, Godzilla Tokyo SOS, not as good as Godzilla Against Mechagodzilla.
Alas, no. It's not as focused, I think, which is the problem.
Same director, and it has the same sort of vibe as the last one, and as Godzilla versus Megaguirus.
Which was practically, Against Mechagodzilla was practically a remake of Megaguirus, and this one, not so much, but it's got similar tone, similar characters.
Yeah. And I like those three.
Yeah.
Godzilla 2000, we said, not a very good movie.
Not especially, no.
And GMK, not fond of that one either.
A lot of people, like, hit us back with that one, saying that they genuinely love that movie. And hey, fair enough. That's the thing about Godzilla movies, and I think that's something it has in common maybe with the Friday the 13th films, in that they're all a collection, but they're very different movies in a lot of ways. They hit the same beats, but they do it in very different ways. And so if you ask people, like, hey, rank all the Friday the 13th movies, you ask any 20 people, no two people are going to have the same list.
Yeah.
Everyone's got, like, one vibe they like a little better, one film they saw first, one outlier that everyone else hates that they think is awesome. And I think that's true with Godzilla as well, because it's been updated, the tone has shifted, it's been rebooted. There's a Godzilla for everybody. And it's disappointing that neither of us liked Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah. I think we both would have really, really liked to. We've heard you. We know it's popular. I think we even said it on the podcast. It's a well-received one. Just didn't scratch an itch for me. It just didn't quite work. I appreciate that it did something weird. I appreciate that it made Ghidorah the hero. Ghidorah the hero? That's weird, right? I can appreciate the novelty in that. I just don't think it came together very well, but whatever. Then again, Against Mechagodzilla, again, awesome. And here we are, Tokyo SOS, in which Mothra is back.
Yeah. Well, we have a half of a movie.
Yeah.
With a not... where we abandon the protagonist. Like, she steps out near the beginning of the movie.
Oh, Akane?
Akane.
Yeah.
The protagonist from the last movie. She's in this, like, to connect
briefly.
She's not the protagonist anymore.
She's basically, if you'll recall, at the end of the last movie, she fought Godzilla in the Mechagodzilla, and, you know, she defeated Godzilla, and Godzilla kind of walked away to nurse his wounds. And she saluted Mechagodzilla at the end. Like, she appreciated that it had, like, kind of a certain agency. And at the beginning of this movie, she shows up, kind of looks at Mechagodzilla, and then looks at one of the new heroes of this movie and says, hey, go get him, Tiger.
Yeah.
And with a slight wistfulness saying, I don't think Mechagodzilla likes fighting.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Here's what I appreciate about that. Although I like Akane, the character.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to see more of her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tendency for sequels to make characters go through the exact same arcs they did in the previous chapter.
Yeah, it's very annoying.
They have to manufacture, like, oh, they didn't grow quite enough, so they have to go through the same arc again.
The worst version of this, I think, was in Major League 2. Right? Throughout all of Major League, all of these ne'er-do-wells... How often do well?
Ne'er.
All these ne'er-do-wells learned how to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And they became, like, an amazing baseball team at the end of the season. And then there's... Major League 2 takes place the next year, and everyone comes back for spring training, and everyone just sucks again for some reason.
Yeah, for no reason.
For no particular reason.
There was a joke like that in the second of the Mighty Ducks pictures.
Oh, yeah. Did you guys practice in the off-season?
Yeah, like, and yeah, it's like, did you practice in the off-season? I think one of the kids says, I knew we were forgetting something. Like,
yeah.
Because they're kind of foolish kids. That makes more sense that they're not good anymore in that film. Akane finished her arc. She kind of bonded with the young girl and with the scientist. Was sort of like this weird... She had this weird relationship where it was like semi-romantic, but also kind of patronly,
yeah.
I thought. But she was able to get over her past, you know, because she went through some trauma with her previous military service. She was really kind of alienated from people, yeah. But she had learned to love people again and, like, kind of formed this ersatz family around her. And her arc was done.
Yeah.
She learned to respect the monster, and that was that. We don't need to go anywhere further with her, so let her walk away.
And
I respect at least that much integrity.
A bad example, it's another bad example of this, is in Pacific Rim Uprising, where you may remember...
Well, they just had new characters in that
one. Well, no, they didn't just have new characters. You might recall that in the original film, there was a character who, in most other like action movies, would have been kind of like a thinly written, just tough woman character. Her name was Mako Mori. Oh, and she was such a well-written character, had such an arc, people really connected to her, that there was actually like sort of like I forget what it's like, the Mako Mori effect or something like that, where... A supporting character is just has their own full arc.
Yeah.
That they get a name for that. So Charlie Hunnam didn't come back for the sequel because he was doing something else. But they brought Mako Mori back to briefly mentor the John Boyega character and then get killed.
Right.
Just pissing all that goodwill away.
Here's the thing.
Again, a slasher movie, I'd get it. I'd say that's fine, but it's not a slasher movie. You know?
I know it's not a slasher movie. I do appreciate when a character that has a lot of goodwill and affection is very unceremoniously wiped out by clumsy filmmaking. I kind of like that. I like that sort of sick, complete lack of integrity.
Maybe, but if my I don't think it was tawdry enough to get away with
maybe
that.
Maybe so.
You know?
My favorite example of that is the movie Alien 3.
Yes. There were practical reasons for that.
There were practical reasons, I understand. One of the characters was a young girl. They couldn't get the same actress. She had grown up.
Yeah, it was like the movie was made like 7 years after the last one, and she was like maybe eight when Aliens came out.
She's not eight anymore.
So they decided to kill her off between movies.
So it's Sigourney Weaver is trying to like save her, and like Michael Biehn also survives, and they get in hypersleep, and then they die in the prologue of Alien 3. They're just dead.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that because people liked them, and I'm glad that they just sort of stabbed everybody in the heart.
See, some people thought like, oh, they promised them. They didn't promise you shit. Here's what they promised. Ripley would go through hell.
Yeah.
That's what all the Alien movies are about. Ripley going through hell. So, yeah, I was totally fine with that. I like how bleak Alien 3 is. I know a lot of people are still mad about it. People are still mad about John Connor and Terminator Dark Fate.
Or they just sort of shot him in the head.
They brought him back in CGI for like four shots, and then a Terminator killed him, and then that was that. And I'm like, what did you... You just wanted to do it again with John Connor? Like the whole... Anyway. So my point is this. I'm not precious. I don't necessarily want everything to continue. And I agree with you. I think there probably is a story they could have done with Akane.
Uh-huh.
But they decided not to go in that direction. And the direction they decided to go in... was we're going to follow another scientist, a young heroic guy. He's an uncle to a young boy. And his father or his uncle is one of the characters in the original Mothra.
That's right.
He's actually played by the same actor, which is very, very cool.
Unfortunately, they don't give a lot to do, like, especially in the second half of the movie. Well, the second half of the movie is just the monsters.
Yeah. The actor is Hiroshi Koizumi, who was also in Godzilla Raids Again.
Okay.
But it's cool that they brought him back, and it also contradicts the last movie, because in the last movie they said Mothra attacked and they killed Mothra.
Mm-hmm.
This one, whoops. I guess we didn't. The movie kicks off, basically, with a brief recap. Godzilla's out there somewhere, and we're looking for Godzilla. Mm. And Mechagodzilla has been under repairs for a year.
Yeah.
Takes
a lot to fix a Mechagodzilla.
It's a really big fucking robot, and they had to take a lot to fix it. They also say at some point that the Absolute Zero weapon, the freeze ray that Mechagodzilla had...
It doesn't work anymore.
Well, it's broken, and they say, like, you know, well, we need this thing back. It's the thing that can stop Godzilla. And the scientist is like, if we bring this back, we need a diamond that's, like, 300 meters in diameter.
Yeah.
Can you bring us that diamond? And then the government guy says, well, budget is a factor. Well, then don't ask. Which is a nice way of saying we have to come up with a new way to kill Godzilla because we can't just do it again.
Yeah.
It'd be a little repetitive if we just use that again, and I get that. And I think it works.
I do like that. No, we can't activate it. We don't have the magic gem. It feels like a Zelda game or something.
Yeah. Well, as we all remember, it operates on Batman and Robin rules. You might recall that Mr. Freeze in Batman and Robin is constantly stealing diamonds.
That's right.
Because he needs diamonds to power his freeze suit.
That's right.
And I like the idea that he's not just, like, putting the diamonds in, like, a mechanism and it's, like, refracting some kind of light beam that powers it. Like, no, he just dumps it in like it's gasoline.
Yeah.
It's a big old handful of diamonds. So if you want your freeze ray to work, you need to get a big giant diamond. And they are trying to get a big giant diamond big enough for a Mechagodzilla suit. Well, you're going to have to rob a lot of jewelry stores in Gotham. So we're not doing that. So we have to come up with another thing. But the action really kicks off when a UFO is flying towards Japan. And I love the image they've got because at first you don't see what it is. It's Mothra. At first you don't see what it is. And it's been a mystery. And it's flying through the clouds. It's
kind of obvious what it is. I actually
didn't see the trailer for this one. I assume Mothra's in the trailer. You want people to know Mothra's in it. It's like the second most popular monster. Mothra's flying through the clouds, and the clouds are pushed up like the ground when Bugs Bunny is burrowing. And well, I just like that effect.
It's a cool effect. The effects on Mothra in this movie are the best yet.
They're really good. It's a very convincing. I like that when it flaps its wings, it looks like they're actually, like, organic and not just big flappers.
They used to be, like, essentially, like, cardboard or plywood. They would just sort of flap up and down.
Or
and
if they were fabric, they were pulled really taut.
I looked up why that was. Like, why does Mothra, like, look so much more dynamic in this movie? And it's because all the previous versions of Mothra, they just sort of dangled from the ceiling. Mm. They dangled it by piano wire.
Mm.
In this one, they actually had, like, an entire marionette system in place.
Ah.
Where they actually had, like, wires pulling down as well.
Ah, kind of that made all the Mothra difference.
Suspended, and they were able to, like, more dynamically flap the wings, so it actually, like, looks much cooler.
It looks a lot cooler. No, you're right. I think this is the best Mothra has ever looked. Yeah. So that's cool. But, Mothra is flying around doing Mothra stuff. And there's this cool bit where, like, the jet pilot, like, a bunch of jet pilots, like, you know, identify yourself. We are jet pilots. And Mothra doesn't say anything, but they hear singing.
Yeah.
Like, they hear sirens, and, like, I half expected them to, like, crash their planes together or something. Like, in, like, the Atlanteans in Wakanda Forever.
Like actual sirens. Okay.
But no. We cut to the house of that young scientist we mentioned earlier. He's there with his nephew, and he's there with Dr. Chujo, who played by Hiroshi Koizumi. And it's the same character he played in Mothra. So now, finally, in the Millennium Era, another film is canon.
Well, they also established some of the other, like, War of the Gargantuas.
Right.
Was
but
also
they,
canon.
But the monster was canon, not necessarily the story. Because they said that they killed it with their maser weapons. Which, by the way, someone has informed me that a maser, actual thing. And the M stands for microwave.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I did no backup research on that.
I'll take somebody's word for it. I don't know about lasers and optics that much.
Now, there's a screenwriting trick I learned from a commentary track on an old Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode where they were writing some episode about some kind of substance that changed people's personality.
Uh-huh.
And there were two nerds in the cast, like the characters. And one of them said, "Oh, it's just like red kryptonite." And the other one said, no, you're thinking of yellow kryptonite. And the writers in the writer's room were like, we know one of those is right. So this way, we've covered all of our bases. One of us is correct.
Without having to do any research.
Yeah, if one of them is either wrong. Xander or Oz. One of them is accurate.
One of them is wrong.
Yeah, boom. So
that's cute.
Our bases are covered. So our bases are covered. Either a maser doesn't exist or it does, and M stands for microwave. Boom. You have the internet. Why do I have to do everything for you? Come on. This is a Godzilla podcast, not a Mazer podcast.
It is a Mazer podcast.
Oh, it is now, I suppose.
That's what we're doing here.
Touche. Anyway, but yeah, the doctor from Mothra has grown up. He's had kids, and his kids had kids, and now he's living with his nephew and grandnephew or something. I'm kind of hazy on the relationships. And all of a sudden, into his house walk the new version of the fairies, or the peanuts, or whatever you want to call them, basically. Yeah. The very small magical women from Infant Island who are the basically speakers of Godzilla. And they say, "Hey, good to see you again. Remember all this stuff?" Anyway.
Remember when you tried to make us perform in that weird flying chariot thing?
That was the Russians?
Or remember? The Americans.
Yeah, there was fictional country that was
America slash Russia country. What the hell was that called?
There was a fictional.
Oh, what was the name of that country?
It was a fictional country that was like a combined Russia and America, which is a fascinating sort of portmanteau. And like, yeah, this one like evil millionaire had kidnapped these two fairies and was forcing them to perform live music shows. Mothra is kind of a weird movie.
I like Mothra.
I like it too. It's kind of a weird movie though. So they say, "Hey, listen, we're back." Mothra is not happy about some shit. So here's the deal. You know when you like moved Godzilla's corpse out of the ocean and desecrated it and like turned it into a weapon of mass destruction? You got to put those bones back, man. That's fucked up. And to sweeten the deal, if you put the bones back, Mothra will protect Japan from Godzilla from now on. Like, that's the... Mothra's willing to do that. But they also
Which sounds like a mob shakedown.
It does, doesn't it? But they also... But here's the reason why it sounds like a mob shakedown is because they also say, and if you don't put the bones back, Mothra will attack Japan. So, I guess we should put those fucking things back. But then their question is, how do we know Mothra's gonna do it? Like, we're putting all of our eggs in one Mothra. Now, I mean, Mothra eggs are pretty big, so I guess that's probably a safe bet. But either way, we're placed in a bit of a quandary. Placed in a bit of a quandary. Anyway.
Rolisica?
Sure.
That was the imaginary country.
Oh, yeah. Rolisica.
Rolisica.
Yeah, yeah. God, that's funny. And they also say something really cryptic. They say, "No human being may touch the souls of the dead." Now, I saw the dub. I don't know if you saw the original version. Of the Millennium Era in particular, it's kind of hard to find the original, like, subtitled version in America.
The TriStar distributed version. TriStar, it should be noted, was distributing these on DVD in the United States.
Yeah.
That's the only way Americans could see the Millennium Era, apart from Godzilla 2000, which was released theatrically.
Yeah, and then the dubs are a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. So, in any case, Mothra is going to declare war on human race. And also, they leave behind a Mothra novelty Scrabble tile.
Which has the old symbol on it from the original Mothra movie.
Yeah, which is a symbol that indeed summons Mothra. And at one point, it's also a Mothra homing beacon.
Yeah.
It's just kind of whatever the screenwriters needed to be.
I don't think it's really clear in the original Mothra. I don't think it's ever been made super clear.
Yeah. Anyway, so...
But then Godzilla comes up out of the sea. Yeah. The idea is... this isn't really consistent throughout these movies, but the idea is that Godzilla is drawn toward the bones that are inside Kiryu.
Now that's what they're saying. Yeah. They're saying that Godzilla is attracted to the corpse of another Godzilla. And also, Kiryu, a.k.a. Mechagodzilla, is not functional, not fully functional, but they've decided to announce that it is as like a publicity thing, just so people know, like, it's okay. We're protected from Godzilla. And as soon as they say that, Godzilla's like, oh, so you are you? Well.
I'm going to test this out here.
So that's a problem. Also, half of the Mechagodzilla team has been sent to study abroad in America. And I think Akane is one of them. And I'm like, this is going nowhere, by the way.
No,
they will not come back with the American cavalry or something like that. It's just basically, here's why all of your favorite characters are gone.
Well, I when I was reading up on this movie, I read that one of the popular interpretations of the film was that Mothra was America. This idea that, you know, I will protect you, but I'm also kind of a threat at the same time.
I mean, that's a very American mentality,
Yeah, this idea that we have to sort of team up with an old rival who are our allies now, but we are still, like, kind of afraid of their destructive power.
Yeah.
That's sort of the symbol that Mothra was supposed to represent in this movie.
I mean, yeah. The one thing that's kind of odd about Godzilla when you follow it all the way through... the metaphors change dramatically.
All the time.
And it's kind of hard to keep track, because you want to, like, attach yourself to the idea that Godzilla represents nuclear devastation, and most of the time he does. Sometimes he represents natural disasters.
Yeah.
Sometimes he represents all of the people who died in World War II that Japan is responsible for. It's kind of all over the place, really. Something was occurred to me while I was watching this, though, because there's a scene where Dr. Chujo goes to the Prime Minister and says, hey, listen, remember Mothra? Anyway, his representatives came to see me.
Kind of weird if you didn't, but
Mothra's representatives came to see me, and they laid down this whole thing about the Godzilla bones, and I'm like, how vital are Godzilla's bones to Mechagodzilla? Surely you can build the chassis without
it. Well, it's not just a structural thing. Remember, there's like the DNA computer that taps into the bones, and the soul of Godzilla's been like going through and like helping out. And
again,
it's semi-alive now.
Is there no way to, especially considering Mechagodzilla's been like piloted by people? Is there no way just to build one without the DNA? Even if it's slightly inferior, like, is that really so impossible?
Excuse me, so you're saying you want deliberately to make an inferior Mechagodzilla?
Listen, there's no such thing as an inferior Mechagodzilla. I'm just saying, if it works slightly differently, I'm fine with it. Anyway, so Godzilla hadn't attacked just yet, by the way. This is when the corpse of the Kamibus...
found on the beach, onshore. Yeah.
And for a second, I was like, is that Gamera? But no, it's the Kamibus.
There was another thing I got to read up on. There was talk for a minute of making that Gamera.
Really?
Which would have been, what an insult. It's Gamera and Godzilla finally crossing over. I think Daiei said, no, you are not. First of all, you can't have Gamera under any circumstances, but B, you definitely can't just have him wash up dead on a beach.
Yeah, like that's extremely anticlimactic. That'd be like, hey, we're doing Batman versus Superman. What's the first scene? Batman washes up dead on the shore. What? Yeah, for Batman.
It would be more like we're making, Superman versus Spider-Man, some sort of crossover between companies
wouldn't
be used to seeing. But then, it's a Superman movie, and Spider-Man is just dead in the first scene.
Yeah,
like, oh no, there's a big threat. It killed Spider-Man.
Not satisfying. Or actually, you know what it is? It's back to Batman v Superman when they brought in Jimmy Olsen and then they shot him in the head in this first scene.
Did that happen?
I don't remember. Yeah, Jimmy Olsen was an FBI agent or a CIA agent, and he was undercover as a photographer with Lois Lane in some war-torn area, and his cover is blown, and they just kill Jimmy Olsen. And I'm like,
edgy.
Yeah, that was kind of the vibe. Like, oh, how mature. And I'm like, I liked Jimmy Olsen. Did we have to kill Jimmy Olsen? Because now he's off the table. We can't just, okay. Weird choices. Anyway. So instead of the zero G weapon, or the absolute zero weapon, they've installed a hyper laser.
Another super maser of some kind. Yeah.
Basically a slightly inferior weapon. See, they did it. And also there's a nice little touch is that Godzilla is battle scarred.
That's from right. The last fight. Got shot in the chest with the absolute zero ray and had like kinda, has a little mark on it.
Had kind of gaping wounds, and now they've like you can see the scar, and they're actually gonna try to aim for that. Like, he's already been weakened, you know? It's like they cracked the glass. So now all we gotta take is one little love tap to kill Godzilla. I'm not sure that's how that works. While Godzilla is attacking and everything's all fucked up, the little kid, Chujo, the doctor's like nephew and the scientist's nephew, he runs away, and we don't know where he's going. And it turns out he goes to his school and starts taking all of the chairs and the desks outside onto the playground. And this kid has a real impeccable sense of space, because he manages to create
the feng shui he has.
No, it's not even that. It's like he creates a dead-on accurate Mothra symbol.
Uh-huh.
But only when viewed from above.
Yeah.
Like from like five stories up, you can see it. Without like a schematic or someone spotting him saying no, a little bit to the left.
Yeah.
Like that kid is good. That kid's got some
I can buy that.
That's fine. I can buy it, but it's also a little thin, but okay, I'm going to let it go. But it is weird. Anyway, yeah, so once that symbol is created, Mothra is like, "Oh, did someone create a visual image somewhere really far from where I am? Well, I guess I'm showing up there."
It's magical.
It sure is.
It's like some magical evocative symbol. It's like, you know, needing a pentagram to summon Satan, that kind of thing.
So Mothra is Satan now.
Sure, yes, okay. Mothra is Satan.
So Mothra shows up. And there's a really great sense of wonder with Mothra. Well,
Mothra, like lands on this, like, hill right, like, like in the backyard of the house. And it looks really cool.
Yeah, just a damn good-looking thing. Mothra does this cool move where, like, he flaps his wings so hard that he creates, like, a wind tunnel at, like...
Well, it's still she in this one.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. She flaps her wings so hard that she pushes Godzilla in through a wind tunnel. Drags him around the city. Godzilla bites one of Mothra's legs off.
And eats it!
Oh my god.
There's like actual like cartoon crunching sound effects.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. Mothra's on the ropes, and that's when another Chujo points out that Mothra is using its weapon of last resort. It is attacking with its own scales.
With the golden glitter we've seen in movies before.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the last movie was where we saw the golden glitter, but it's.
I think it's a Mothra thing. I think it was in the Mothra solo movies, but I don't think it was used to the same effect.
Yeah,
I think it was just used like that in the
Godzilla. Oh wait, no, it was in Rebirth of Mothra 2, I believe. Yeah. The one where Mothra was like stuck on the top of the pyramid. Mm-hmm.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
So they need to save Mothra by launching Mechagodzilla, but ironically, that's what Mothra didn't want.
they abandon that, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Mothra doesn't follow up on the whole skeleton thing.
He does defend, she does defend Japan.
Yeah.
That whole thing is basically dropped. Meanwhile, the fairies are back on Infant Island, and they're singing to a Mothra egg. It's like, oh, here we go again.
The techno version of Mothra, yeah.
Yeah. So they summon Mothra, the egg hatches, and it's two Mothras, which we've had before. You may recall.
Godzilla versus Mothra.
Yeah. There
were two Mothra babies.
Yeah. They're going to immediately, upon being born, run to Japan, or swim to Japan, I guess, to kick Godzilla's ass, which is a lot to ask of a newborn.
Yeah, but it has the ancient soul of the reincarnated Mothra.
I don't know. I'm just saying it's still a big day.
Yeah.
You know? Like, what was on your to-do list? Well, first I was born, and then I kicked Godzilla's ass. What are you going to do on your second day? I don't know. It's like lunch?
I was born. It's like Ozu. I was born, but.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And also, while all of this is going on, the uncle and the little kid nephew are, the old man and nephew are pinned by rubble. And our hero scientist has to run off and save them. Mm. And he's trying to find them, and it turns out the Mothra tile helps him find them, and he does. And it's like, okay, good, we got him. Well done, everybody.
Okay, are we about ready to, like, just give the plot a miss and have, like,
I mean, basically
40 minutes of monster action?
I mean, basically,
that's what happens in the rest of the movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of fucking fighting. There's, like, a cool bit where Godzilla gets flipped over Mechagodzilla's head.
Yeah.
That was fucking badass. Godzilla sweeps Mechagodzilla's legs, and as it's falling, he shoots radioactive breath in its face, which is awesome. Let's see. Mothra takes... So, like, Mothra... You don't really throw yourself in front of a bullet, but Mothra throws itself in front of Godzilla's heat breath to save its own kids.
Yeah.
Like, that was pretty badass. Like, again, busy day. Let's see here. Meanwhile, our scientist guy, Mechagodzilla's fucked. So he's going to try to repair it on site. Again, the last thing this thing broke, it took a year to fix it mostly.
Mm.
Round the clock, scientists and mechanics. And this guy is just going to hit it with a wrench.
Isn't that something that happened in Star Wars in Return of the Jedi? Where they were building a second Death Star.
They were building a second Death Star, yeah.
It's not complete. We had to rush this one. The last one took, like several decades to make.
The main weapon is operational, but we're still, you know, the living quarters aren't done yet. So everyone's kind of sleeping in the halls.
Which makes you wonder why they needed all that extra stuff if they already have a planet-killing laser they can just sort of fly around.
I mean, in Rise of Skywalker, they just attach that thing to a Star Destroyer.
Yeah, they just put it on a ship. It can fly around and destroy planets.
It's a big fucking gun, but does it need to be the entire planet? Apparently fucking not.
Mm.
So, great. Now we ruined Star Wars for everybody.
Oh, no. George Lucas did that. Hey!
Ah, that's rough. What was it? Anyway, someone was online today, and
Someone was online today?
Right? But someone posted a thing online the day we recorded this. It was about how the trailer for the new Star Wars series, The Acolyte, came out. They weren't happy with it. Apparently, there was some kind of inconsistency. And they said something to the effect of, they need to respect the lore and not just make stuff up.
Wait a minute.
All of Star Wars is made up.
This is fiction.
None of it happened. So we're just making it all up. Mm. And the thing is that when you... And this is true with Godzilla as well, which brings it back. Even if you try to maintain continuity, because, like, this is two movies.
Yeah.
Against Mechagodzilla and Tokyo SOS are two movies. And even these two movies don't have strict continuity. If you keep making movies, if you keep telling stories in the same universe, eventually, either by the needs of the story or the characters or just by accident, you're going to contradict yourself.
Yeah.
There's going to be something that doesn't fall together perfectly, or there's something that gets retconned. And you just kind of have to live with that. We can joke about it. We can even complain when it makes no sense, but it's just going to happen.
It's been particularly strong with Godzilla.
Yeah.
Because the Godzilla movies very deliberately, especially in the Millennium Era,
yeah,
dispense with the idea of continuity.
Well, yeah, because most of them are like reboots of each other. Yeah.
I think a lot of people were spoiled by the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
The idea that these things are being planned out well in advance, and one movie's going to interlink with something else. And,
even those have inconsistencies.
Yeah, and they're going to like drop in a hint here, and it's going to come into play like four movies down the line. Like, people really lived for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They took notes while watching these superhero movies.
And it suggested that that's the status quo. And I think if you grew up with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you might have been spoiled on that, because that's not generally how it works.
No, and you know, you and I, we've talked about this a lot. We grew up in an era when it was kind of bad luck to mention a sequel until the previous film was out. You didn't come out in the trades and say, hey, we've decided to make this into a trilogy before the first film's released. That was considered like really arrogant.
Yeah. Or even after the first film's released, they're going to make three more. No.
You're going to make one more and see if that one's a hit. And if that one's a hit, then you're going to make another one.
Like, you might have the casting on contract to be in more than one, but you're not going to announce him.
Yeah.
At best, it's gauche. Mm. At worst, you're setting yourself up for a fall. And we've seen this happen a ton of times.
That changed in the last 15 years, where, you know, the actors were signing on to, you know, 6, 12 films at a time.
Yeah.
And the producer became sort of the showrunner, essentially, of where all these things were going to go. So I understand why a lot of critics might be stepping out at this point and saying, you need to respect continuity. You need to think of that, because they're thinking of what they grew up with, which was Marvel.
Yeah.
You come over here to Godzilla.
Yeah.
Where, even though Toho is very protective of Godzilla, and they want to make sure they make the right kinds of Godzilla in the right ways, and they have the same kind of creative teams moving from film to film, they still don't really give a damn about plot.
Yeah.
The Godzilla movies aren't about plot. They're not even about human characters. They're about one character, and that's the monster.
There are a few exceptions to that, but yes.
Exceptions, but, you know,
generally speaking, we're here for Godzilla.
We're here for Godzilla.
We're here for Godzilla the same way we're here for Jason Voorhees.
Exactly. Yeah. We want to see Godzilla do Godzilla stuff.
That's mostly why we're here, yes.
And in this movie, there's a hell of a lot of Godzilla stuff.
There's so much Godzilla stuff. Like, Godzilla's fighting.
It's almost tiresome, actually.
It goes on for a while. Like, I realized this when I was younger. I had fantasies about what, like, my ultimate movie would be. What kind of movie would I make? And it was always, like, these wall-to-wall badass action sequence. It's going to be like a 2-hour action sequence. It's going to be the coolest thing ever. And eventually I mellowed out, and now like I try to watch The Raid, and I'm like, oh, I'm getting real exhausted with this, actually. can we talk for a few minutes just to reset the pace? What are we doing here?
Some people
love that stuff, but it's I'm at a point now where pacing's nice.
Pacing is nice. I've heard it said before that a good action sequence, you need to know the characters going in.
It helps.
First of all, I think that's kind of BS. I think you can have a spectacular action sequence not knowing anything about the characters.
First scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Spectacular action sequences, you do not know that guy.
You a little bit, like through what he's communicating.
You get a sense of him, but you don't know his character.
No, you don't know his backstory. You don't know why he's getting this thing.
Yeah, that is he an archaeologist? Is he a thief? What is he? We don't know.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But you love that sequence because it's just really well choreographed.
Well, it gives you all the information you need in that sequence, you know?
Well, that's all you need. A little information. Yeah. You don't need to care about the characters deeply.
Yeah. It needs to be clear what's going on and what's at stake.
Yeah.
Basically. And you can get a lot of leeway on top of that. I think it helps if you care about the characters a little bit, because then, like...
Perhaps.
I think it helps. I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt, I think. I've never watched an action sequence and been like, oh, I care about this character. Fuck you! Like, that's never been an issue for me. Mm-hmm. But in any case, the wall-to-wall action of some of these Godzilla movies, it does get a little exhausting after a while. Man. This one does have a bunch of cool stuff. Like, there's this cool bit where the mechanic is, like, driving a motorcycle to get to the Mechagodzilla husk so he can fix it, and he has to drive it through the subway. Awesome. And, like, Godzilla and Mechagodzilla and Mothra are, like, fighting, and they, like, punch through the road into the subway, and, like, on top of the guy, and he has to, like, swerve around it, and I'm like, well, that's fucking awesome. I love all of that. He gets to Mechagodzilla. It's really dinged up, and he can only find, like, one hatch that he can enter in order to fix it, but he does, and he fixes it, and he tells everybody, like, okay, good, now Mechagodzilla's working and stuff. And they're like, okay, cool. You got out of there, right? And the hatch is broken now, and he's trapped inside Mechagodzilla. And he says, yeah, I got out. Willing to sacrifice himself.
Yeah, a little bravery.
Good heroism, yeah. Right? Like, I'm with him, and there's this bunch of this really cool stuff where, like, there's a huge fight, and he's getting, like, thrown around inside Mechagodzilla, and all that stuff's fucking cool. The two younger Mothras, the older Mothra dies, because, of course, older Mothra
Yeah, Godzilla dies. Trashes yeah. older Mothra.
And the younger Mothras, they're doing quite good, actually, but their one big move, really, is we're going to spin a web. You know, cocoon him.
Yeah, like they did in Mothra versus Godzilla.
Yeah, it's time-consuming, but it works. I do like the little bits, because, like, the Mothras are so low to the ground that, like, Godzilla loses them in the city, and he's, like, hunt around for them. That was kind of fun. But, yeah, so they're cocooning him. That's taken a while. Mechagodzilla, Mechagodzilla once again acts of its own accord and decides it's going to end this once and for all. It grabs Godzilla in a cocoon and flies it out into the ocean, basically to where the corpse of the original Godzilla was.
Returning it to the sea.
It to the sea.
And it too is also like returning itself. The skeleton's going back to the bottom of the
ocean. I'm not sure I know Mechagodzilla wants to be laid to rest like a ghost. Like, please put my bones back in the cemetery kind of thing. I'm not sure that's what Godzilla wanted.
No, but but that's what he's getting.
I guess so. I'm not sure that's fair.
He's got to lump it.
Because if we believe this movie, if we believe this movie and its supposition that Godzilla only was attacking because they took the bones of the original Godzilla, which doesn't actually work in the Against Mechagodzilla timeline, but again, we're continuity be damned. If we follow this movie at its word. Godzilla was just mad that you desecrated a corpse.
Maybe.
That sounds like what they're saying is Godzilla, Mothra's mad. Why wouldn't Godzilla be mad? So, like, you took the bones of, like, imagine if there was, like, only two human beings in the world. And you knew them, you loved them, they were your brother, your family, something. And they died. And then, like, the next animal on the food chain, you know, like bears, like a bunch of bears took the corpse of like the only other human and decide to like turn it into a killer cyborg.
Oh,
you'd be pissed. You'd be like, wait a minute. I came to request that you politely turn that back, and instead you attacked me, so I'm gonna attack you, and now all of a sudden I'm the bad guy. And I just feel like, I don't know, man. I often do, I feel bad for Godzilla. I do. Godzilla, he's either just an animal and doesn't deserve any of this shit, or there's some kind of logic to him. And he's either some form of righteous vengeance, or he's trying to, like, there's an argument to be made that, like, in some of these Millennium movies, he's trying to, like, save humanity from our own self-destruction. Like, every time we build a new dangerous energy source, Godzilla comes along and says, don't do that, slaps it out of our hand. He's not wrong. Like, again, I don't know, I always feel bad. Ever since King Ghidorah, when we found, I've said this before, but I think it's the most important scene in all of Godzilla history, when Mothra is trying to convince Godzilla and Rodan to save the humans from King Ghidorah. And Godzilla and Rodan said, why? They're always mean to us. And it really puts it all in perspective, doesn't it?
Well, there's that, and there's something, and I think this is something that a lot of American audiences, in particular, won't necessarily grasp about Godzilla.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go back to not just Marvel, but the way we think about heroes and villains in action movies in general.
Sure.
There are good guys and there are bad guys. I've said this before, they murder at an equal clip, good guys and bad guys. Sometimes the good guys murder more people than the bad guys.
Yeah.
We see them just, you know, mowing down, henchmen.
Yeah. It's interesting in like the Marvel movies, how they, especially like the bigger ones, the Avengers ones, there's always like a faceless army at the end. Like, we're going to fight a whole bunch of Ultrons. Yeah. So we can kill them and no one cares. And we're getting all the devastation, but less of the guilt.
Yeah. Like, I think it's explained in that movie that they all share a consciousness. So you're not killing anybody.
Yeah. 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 And then, you don't have to feel too bad about watching the Avengers rip someone's head off.
Yeah. Like, that's fun now.
Yeah. But every once in a while, they just rip someone's head off. Like Iron Man will just go to a city and kill everybody because he's like, oh, they're bad. Okay, fine.
But the difference being, you know, when a hero shoots someone in the head, that is a heroic act because they are a hero.
Yeah.
They must
be right.
Exactly. Their actions are dictated by their pre-established moral standing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, if a villain kills somebody, that is a villainous act because they have been defined as a villain and all of their actions are colored by that. It's not the other way around.
No.
Their actions don't define their heroism or their villainy. Mm. Their actions are defined by their moral definitions.
The one, I think, exception to that is the characters who hold themselves to a higher moral standard, which is typically Batman and Superman.
Yeah.
Superman wants to be a paragon of virtue. And Batman needs to differentiate himself from the people he's fighting because otherwise he understands there's no difference.
Yeah.
So, like, the one line he won't cross is, I don't kill anybody. Mm. That's the one thing. If I do that, I'm just a madman in a mask just like they are. But, like, at the very least.
Of course he is. He murdered all those clowns, but...
well, that's in the movie. I'm talking about in the comics. In the comics, that's always been more important.
All right.
And there's also been exceptions. But, like, generally speaking... there are certain comic book characters who believe that if they ever kill anybody, they've lost the moral high ground forever.
Okay.
And I personally like that. I think there are definitely characters who don't pretend to be paragons of virtue. The Punisher, for example.
There you go.
The Punisher knows he's a bad guy.
Uh-huh.
Like, I kill people that I think deserve it, and a lot of people agree, but I'm a monster.
I do kill these people.
Yeah, the Punisher has no illusions about what type of person he is. He's basically a serial killer, but everyone's fine with the people he kills.
There is, when it comes to, like, comic book heroes, there's a little bit of a line that is obnoxious. Like, I won't cross that line. Really? Because you're on it all the time.
Yeah.
But the point I'm getting at here is this idea of good versus evil, this dualistic moral version of action heroes.
If you're not good, you're evil, and vice versa.
Yeah, that's a very American notion.
Mm.
And you'll see it in a lot of American movies. Mm. That's the way American action films are all set up. Hero versus villain.
Yeah.
Godzilla is neither hero nor villain.
Generally speaking,
Godzilla is a force of nature.
Yeah.
And can be interpreted many ways throughout his life.
Just like a force of nature can. Like, a lot of weather. Oh, good, we needed the rain. Or, it killed a bunch of people.
Godzilla Godzilla is very powerful, and but we don't admire the power so much as we stand in awe of it.
Yeah.
We respect, well, not respect, but we kind of recognize that Godzilla does have the power to destroy everything, but also the power to defend.
Yeah.
This is the way we look at nuclear armaments.
Yeah.
This is the way we look at natural disaster. Not that the good comes of natural disasters, but we stand in awe of the power and understand that we're powerless in the face of it. It's not a good or a bad thing.
Well, in a macro sense, you know, some natural disasters have a kind of a cleansing effect, like a forest fire brush. Yeah. It kills all the brush, like all the dead trees, and now new trees can grow, which sucks for everything living in that forest during the fire, but
it's great for the things that spring up afterwards.
On a 1,000-year scale, it isn't all a downside. So, something comes of it, at least.
And I think what we're getting at here, this idea of, like, continuity and trying to figure out, like, arcs of these characters... they're not solid for a reason in Godzilla.
Yeah.
Because Godzilla isn't a hero or a villain. Godzilla does not have an arc. Godzilla is. Godzilla is simply doing what Godzilla does.
Yeah.
And there's not going to be a development for that. There's going to be us down here unable to control it.
Yeah.
And only attempts to fight it. There's Mazer tanks in this.
Yeah.
All the Mazer tanks in the world. will not handle it.
I think this is one of the reasons why we're almost there. The legendary MonsterVerse movies have a very particular view on Godzilla, in that Godzilla is part of the Earth's ecosystem.
Yeah.
That Godzilla arises because other monsters arise, and there needs to be a certain equilibrium. He's Earth's balancer once again. But then I guess King Kong serves that same function. But anyway, the point is this. He will destroy stuff, but he's ultimately trying to maintain a sense of balance. Yeah. So I think in those movies, that's their attempt to allow Godzilla to be destructive while also having all of the characters look at Godzilla and like, no, he's all right.
Yeah.
You know, he's got his heart in the right place. Like everybody likes Godzilla.
He killed thousands of people, but it's like, but
he saved millions.
Saved millions, and also Godzilla's just doing what Godzilla does. You can't resent an animal,
yeah,
for behaving like an animal.
Yeah, especially when it just like, you know, saved your kid from like a rabid, yeah, Wolverine or something. You know, it's like, okay, well, thanks. Well done. Here's a treat. Uh-huh. Here's a biscuit. Anyway, back to the movie. Mechagodzilla flies Godzilla out over the ocean. But our hero mechanic is still in there. And he's ready to die. And his cohorts figure out that he's in there. And they shoot open the door. And then Mechagodzilla flips. So he falls out of Mechagodzilla onto one of the other planes. And as he's falling out of Mechagodzilla, there's a screen inside Mechagodzilla that says goodbye Sayonara, to him by name. And I'm like, okay, so not only did he have a general sense of his own existence.
That's right.
He could hack the computer and talk? What a missed opportunity. Oh, well, anyway.
But it's kind of a tragic ending.
It is.
Because, you know, Godzilla's destroyed.
Yeah.
Brought back to the bottom of the ocean. And the original Godzilla gets to, yeah, like you said, it's like a ghost returning to its grave.
Yeah.
And I like that ending.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. There's a big, people have big speeches. Well, we've learned something today. Something, humility. And then credits roll. And then at the end of the credits, there's one more tease.
The filmmaker wanted to leave the door open for a direct sequel.
Sure.
So, they did it
to the post-credits thing in this one is, it's basically a Raiders of the Lost Ark ending. They saved some Godzilla DNA.
Yeah.
It's in a vault somewhere. So, they could clone Godzilla or something, if they wanted to.
And other monsters, too.
And other monsters, yeah. So, like, a perfectly valid door left open for sequels. And we'll never go there, unfortunately. Because next time...
Because this movie bombed.
Oh, did it really bomb that bad?
Like, these last two movies didn't do very well.
Even against Mechagodzilla?
I think the last one made like $18 million in American dollars, and this one only made $15 million equivalent in American dollars.
That's not great.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because at least against Mechagodzilla, it's fucking awesome. But in any case, yeah, this is the end of this continuity, again. And there's only one more film left in the Millennium era. It is, however... at least intended, to be the Godzilla movie to end all Godzilla movies. Well, the ultimate fan service Godzilla movie.
We're on the 50th anniversary of Godzilla. Yeah. It's going to come out in 2004.
Yeah.
And they're going to get every possible monster.
Yeah.
That they can just cram into this thing.
Yeah. And so we're going to be talking about Ryuhei Kitamura's Godzilla Final Wars.
From the director of The Midnight Meat Train.
Okay, he's done other things.
No, just those two.
Just those two movies.
No, Ryuhei Kitamura is actually a pretty prolific filmmaker.
Yeah, no, he is. I'm trying to think, there's another movie of his. Oh, he did Izumi, which really kicks ass.
I haven't seen Izumi.
Yeah. That movie was. That's an awesome modern, it's not set in the present day, but like relatively recent samurai movie. I find when people tend to talk about samurai movies as classics in America, they're mostly thinking about movies from like the 50s and 60s and 70s, but there have been some really good ones in the last few decades, and Izumi is definitely one of them. I love that fucking movie.
Did you see Twilight Samurai?
I did. That movie's amazing. It's
so good.
That movie's fucking great.
Here's what I remember about Godzilla Final Wars. It sucks. I remember it being really bad filmmaking. It has that sort of mid-2000s... ultra-saturated, grainy digital photography that never looked good. The special effects are quite bad.
Yeah.
At least most of the monsters are going to be done in, like, suits.
Okay.
The only one that's in CG was one that we've already seen in CG before.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
And there is a, I remember there was a pretty fun fight with like a mega Gigan at the end.
Yeah, Gigan
comes back for this next one.
We have been, this is one of the ones we've been looking forward to because A, Whitney doesn't like it. and B, I've never seen it and it's full of a bunch of shit. And I'm looking forward.
It's full of a bunch of shit. Put that on the poster. Godzilla, you know, Final Wars. Like, it's full of a bunch of shit.
Like, listen, some movies are good, some movies are bad, but whether they're good or bad, some movies give you your money's worth.
Yeah.
Like, it's full of a bunch of stuff, isn't it? Like, you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff on screen.
Also, remember, it's long. I think this is over two hours, which is unusual for a Godzilla movie.
It is very long for Godzilla. Let me take a look here. It's just over 2 hours. It's 125 minutes.
Yeah.
So buckle up, everybody.
And there's aliens in it. There's, like, kung fu aliens and motorcycle chase. Like, you're just going to throw everything at the wall.
You're making it sound awesome. So, and maybe it is. Maybe it is. Yeah. I haven't seen it. I've never seen it in its entirety. I've only seen a few clips here and there of some of the various monster fights. So, that's coming up next on Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. If you want to hear that episode about Godzilla Final Wars right now, if you're listening to this on the main feed, all of our episodes come out 1 week early on Patreon. You can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You get all of our new episodes ad-free, and you get our Godzilla episodes 1 week early. A huge thank you to all of our patrons. We really can't do this without you. Times are hard.
Yeah.
So if you have the means to support the show, we deeply appreciate it. And if you don't, we totally get it.
Oh, don't.
Yeah.
We don't want anybody to make their own situations worse.
No, don't put yourself out. But like, if you have the money, we're very grateful.
We're grateful, you know? Even if it's just a couple bucks. You know,
And we want to make sure you get something for that. So even if for $1 a month, you get ad-free shows, you get early episodes, and you get quite a few of the exclusive shows in our library. To enjoy. And at the higher tiers, you get more shows, more elaborate shows. Our Star Trek show, we do every Star Trek episode ever. We do a show where we review every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture, and every single movie ever nominated for Best International Feature.
Mm-hmm.
And we do hangouts. We're overdoing a commentary track. We owe you a commentary track.
We have one in the hopper. It's in front of us.
We just got to get to it. Got to be able to sit down for 2 hours and get it done. But we will. So just a huge shout out. If you want to support the show and you can't afford to, you just leave us a review.
Yeah.
It really helps. It helps so much. You have no idea. The star rating, one sentence, doesn't matter. Just it really, 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 really helps. Pushes up the algorithm so that we'll be recommended to other people and more people will find out about it. And maybe, you know, you'll run into someone on the bus and they'll have their earbuds in. Hey, buddy, what you listening to? Oh, I'm listening to Critically Acclaimed. Hey, me too. Now we're friends. And then you get married, and it's nice.
You'll make friends and get married.
Yeah.
You listen to our podcast.
Yes, you'll make friends and get married.
You'll
That's
going to
be our new shirt. Critically acclaimed. Make friends. Get married.
You'll even smell better. I don't know.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? You can also write to us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail, or you can send us physical mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we're on social media, at Critic Acclaim. He's at Whitney Seibold.
That's right.
I'm at William Bibiani.
That's right.
I think that's it.
That's it. You said it all.
We're good. So, once again, you're awesome. Have a great week. We'll see you next Friday. And, rawr.